supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, how did you sleep last night? I hope the answer is well, but for 10% of us, we have chronic insomnia, and the answer is not good. Another 35% of us have intermittent insomnia, so that means almost half of our population has difficulty sleeping. I remember the first time I couldn't sleep. I was 8 years old, and I was worrying about something the next day. That pattern has continued off and on for the rest of my life. For most with insomnia, the desire to sleep can become fraught with so much anxiety that sleep becomes almost impossible. I've been sleeping well over the last several months, and frankly, the thought of talking about it for an hour is a little scary to me. I didn't want to jinx it, as good sleep feels so precious and so fragile. But insomnia is a serious issue for those who suffer with it. They're at increased risk for depression, hypertension, anxiety disorders, and a slew of others. Well, what's new? What can be done about it? What are we learning about it? Joining me to discuss insomnia is Gail Green. She is an insomnia sufferer for more than 40 years and author of the book Insomniac. Gail, thanks for joining us today on Voices.
Thank you.
Also joining me is Dr. Phil Gierman. He is from the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at the University of Pennsylvania. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And if you haven't slept or have last night or have difficulty sleeping in general, give us a call. It's 1-800-477-9499. Again, that's, 888-477-9499. Gail, I want to begin by reading the first paragraph of your book, Insomniac. It's a powerful description of what insomnia has done for your life. Excuse me. The first thing to go, is your sense of humor. Then goes the desire to do things you used to do. Then the desire to do anything at all. Parts of your body ache that you didn't even know the names of, and your eyes forget how to focus. Words you once knew aren't there anymore, and there's less and less to say. People you once cared about fall by the way, and you let them go also. Gail, tell me your first memories of insomnia.
Well, my first memories don't go too far back. They are really high school. I remember being in agony. I just, the early hour, I mean, I had to be at this corner to catch the bus by 7:30, and I'd usually had, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 hours of sleep, and I was just a zombie. And it was, high school was a kind of a blur. I remember I would hit the sweets. They had a vending machine that had some sweets in it at recess, and I would just try to stay awake. And then I'd get home and I'd take a nap, and that was a very bad pattern, of course, because it would push my sleep later. And I also remember having a very volatile temper. Of course, hormones in adolescence, you know, exacerbate that. It's interesting that my first sharpest memory should be of it in adolescence, because that's when it often comes on for women. Up until puberty, males and females sleep more or less the same. And then puberty, that you get this big differentiation of many more women, girls, sleeping worse than boys. And that seems to indicate there's a hormonal component.
So you are not aware of having difficulty before your adolescence, or did you? And do me a favor, please, Gail. Speak directly into the phone. Your voice is kind of fading in and out.
It's awfully early for me at this end.
Yeah, I want to talk about that too. But
I think I'm fading in that. But I will try to do this. But okay, I'm not aware because I don't remember. But my mother, I found letters after my mother died. She had written my father. He was away during World War II, and he was away for a year and a half, and. She wrote him about three times a week, so there's this amazing amount of detail about me, and she's trying to give him the experience that he's missing of his, you know, baby growing up. And so I was 6 months to 2 years old, and these letters, which were very, very painful for me to go and read, and I found ways of putting off the reading because I didn't, you know, it was just so. It was all, they were very much in love, and they had all this future and hopes about the future. And but I realized I had to read it for the sleep book to find out if there was anything in there about my sleep. And oh boy, there was an earful. I mean, it was all about my sleep. It was like I could never get her to sleep. You know, when I do get her to sleep, there's a surge of 4 a.m. energy. She's up shaking the crib.
Well,
that
argues for physiology much more than psychology.
It certainly does, you know, particularly since this was not about night terrors or about nightmares. She describes me as this happy, bubbly, you know, kid who turned everything into a game and had a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And it was really just about not wanting to let go of the day and having this nighttime energy. I then could sleep until 9. I mean, I slept later than most babies, but it was.
So let's come back to a comment you made just a few minutes ago. You said it's very early for you, and I know you're in California, so it's 9 a.m. there. Mm-hmm. What's your typical sleep pattern?
About 3 to 11, yeah.
3 a.m. till 11 a.m.
And I'm lucky, I'm an academic, and I get to schedule, I have control over my hours, so I can do that. I can just sort of, you know, I can use that late night surge of energy to work and to, you know, get things done.
So can I ask you a question? Obviously, I'm the interviewer.
You get to do that.
So why in God's name did you agree to do this?
Because I think this is so important. People are so in the dark about sleep, bad pun. But I think I learned something doing this sleep book, and I just want to share it with especially insomniacs, but also friends of insomniacs and families and doctors and whoever will listen. So it's a great opportunity for me to get to say what I learned doing the book. That's why.
All right. I will work as hard as I can to keep you awake for the next 45 minutes. Oh, okay. All right, I was going to put some pressure on Phil to do it also. Phil, let's bring you into the conversation here. When we listen to Gail, and I'm going to oversimplify, but it seems like, you know, Gail is getting her full night's sleep. She's just not in the sleep cycle that, you know, the rest of us say you should be in. So,
but you know, I have to tell you, it's a broken night, and I usually take some Ambien in the later part of it. So it's just not that simple.
Right. Of course, it's not. But I wonder, turning to you, Phil, you know, how much of insomnia is, you know, just people's hard wiring to be in a different, you know, cycle than the rest of the culture.
It's really an overlooked problem, and clinically I see all the time where people will tell me, in distinction from what Gail's reporting, is people will say, if I go to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, I sleep okay, but I need to be up at 7 o'clock to get into work on time. So for some people, the main problem is this mismatch of their body's preference for timing and the schedule that they need to keep. Now, some people have the double whammy of they may be more of a night owl by nature, but then even when they sleep in line with what their body wants, they're still not getting good sleep.
Which sounds more like Gail.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So is there a way, you know, if a body calls for one to be a night owl,
mm-hmm.
and they have to be up at 7, can you alter your body's need? Is a body easier to manipulate than a mind?
It varies. I often say that some people's bodies are more resistant to shifting than others, but there are a few strategies we have that are often successful for helping people to shift earlier. Those are either bright light therapy, melatonin, or something called chronotherapy, where you systematically move your schedule ahead rather than back.
What do you mean?
We know that what advice people are often given is, well, just go to bed 15 minutes earlier each night, and then you'll slowly get to the schedule you want to keep. And we know that doesn't work. You can't force your body forwards. However, we have much greater control at our ability to force ourselves to stay up. So the way chronotherapy works is each night you go to bed 2 hours later. So if you tend to fall asleep at 2 a.m., you start at 2 a.m., then you go to bed at 4 a.m., 6 a.m., 8 a.m., and you gradually move your rhythms of sleep around the clock till you get to the time that you want to fall asleep. It can be pretty effective, but it means for a period of 1 to 2 weeks, you need to have complete control over your schedule.
Oh, my God, sounds grueling.
Yeah. About the only time I've actually had the opportunity to put it into practice is with college students who are on break.
You mentioned melatonin.
Mm-hmm.
That's an over-the-counter drug.
It is.
And that's way different than all the other drugs because, you know, we've got a lot of callers are asking about Ambien and all the others. Mm-hmm. What are the long-term effects? Melatonin's different.
It is, but there's two ways to use melatonin. As a sleeping pill, melatonin is pretty ineffective. There seem to be some people for whom it works, but taking it, say, 30 minutes before you want to go to bed, as you would most sleeping pills, most people don't get much benefit, and the controlled studies have been pretty disappointing. However, where melatonin can be more effective is what we call a chronobiotic, meaning you're using it to shift your rhythms of sleep, but the timing is completely different. Then you're taking it generally 4 hours before you want to go to sleep. So with a sleeping pill, it's usually not going to work.
Hmm. Let's see if we can get a call in before our break to follow up this discussion. We've got Rosemary on the line.
Hello. How you doing?
Okay.
I'm calling because as a woman who has rheumatoid arthritis, it's very important for me to get a lot of sleep and, you know, be well rested, or else it causes a lot of pain when I don't get rest. As a result of getting the rheumatoid arthritis, it threw my body into early menopause because it's an autoimmune disorder. So I've got the double whammy of having the rheumatoid arthritis and then full menopause, which in itself disrupts your sleep pattern. So my doctor prescribed Ambien, and I have found that if I don't take it, I just do not sleep. And it really worries me that I'm so dependent on this. And, you know, looking for what your response would be to the long-term effects of this or...
Well, yeah, I'd like to hear from both my guests. Phil, let's start with you. But, Gail, you've become an expert on this also.
I sure have.
Rosemary, thanks for your call.
You know, you have to do risk-benefit calculations on taking a medication, I think. I mean, my chapter is called Rock, Hard Place, because that's where we are with these drugs. You know, if you don't take them, there can be horrible consequences. I mean, the consequence of not sleeping does all sorts of damage to your body and your mind and your mood and your, you know, ability to function and, in your case, pain. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand is maybe the drug will have, over time, bad consequences. Now, we don't know that because there haven't been long-term studies. You know, I'm taking that chance. I take Ambien these days every night. I have strict things about keeping the dose down. I take it only in the second part of the night after I've had some sleep of my own. You know, I play all sorts of tricks with it so that the dose is down and I'm not drugging my sleep all the time, and I try to skip it from time to time. And it's, you know, it's like having a bear by the nose or something, taking a pill. But I have to say, I pretty much depend on that drug. And to me, the quality of life issues, the unknown effect of what Ambien might do to you over time, as opposed to the known effect of what sleep loss will do to me in the immediate, makes it worth it to me. Although there are some days when I'm in a fog and a funk, and I think, is this the Ambien or is it me? That I think this is a little scary. You know, it is scary. So you have to make those calculations for yourself. There's nobody who can tell you that, and you have to do trial and error. Maybe the drug you know that works for you is not Ambien. Maybe it'll be something else. Only you can find that out. The doctor can't tell you. So you have to do trial and error, and then you have to monitor yourself to make sure the drug is not creating personality changes or doing something weird like making you, you know, gain 100 pounds.
Phil, let me turn to you. I know you're not a medical doctor and you're a psychologist, but drugs like Ambien also, I am told, also affect sleep architecture too. Don't they affect REM sleep so that the quality of sleep you get with Ambien is also impaired?
It can be the fact that you may sleep. It may not be completely natural or top quality sleep, but
it's better than being awake.
Exactly.
Let's take a short break because I want to get into what research is going on, what we're learning. Apparently, we're learning a lot over the last decade, which is when I had my last sleep study. We're talking about insomnia today. If you've got a question, comment, if you've had difficulty sleeping, give us a call. We're at 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. We've got a couple of lines open, so please call quickly. My guests are Gail Green. She's a professor of English at Scripps College, author of the book Insomniac. Dr. Phil Gierman is an assistant professor in psychiatry and clinical director of behavioral sleep medicine program at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Dan Gottlieb. This is Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's festival brings Sonny Landreth, Iron and Wine, The Decemberists, Tom Rush, the Derek Trucks Band, and more to the Old Pool Farm near Schwenksville, PA, the weekend of August 14th, 15th, and 16th. With 3 days of folk music and dance, concerts, crafts, camping, and children's activities, the Philadelphia Folk Festival, August 14th through 16th. For details, 1-800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
Greg, I am sick and tired of good music not getting heard.
That's right, Jim. There are tons of great records out there that deserve more attention.
I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot.
And this week on Sound Opinions, the world's only rock and roll talk show, we're going digging for buried treasures to provide some new musical gems.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about insomnia with Gail Green. She's author of the book Insomniac. And Dr. Phil Gierman, he's clinical director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at the University of Pennsylvania. Gail, your diagnosis is psychophysiological insomnia. Can you explain what the psychophysiological part implies?
Well, it's a kind of a catch-all term for insomnia that is not clearly related to either an egregious kind of psychological problem or a obvious medical problem. And so it's thought to be a kind of combination of some kind of psychophysiological, possibly based in physiology and then made worse by psychology, or possibly based in psychology and then, which then alters physiology. It's a kind of imprecise term. It's sort of tries to be destigmatizing. It's not saying that you're an insomniac because you're a nut, you know, because you're depressed, you're anxious, you're stressed out, and yet that does seem to be the kind of catch-all explanation for much insomnia, that, you know, this is something we bring on ourselves. It's all in our heads. It's something we could get hold of if we had better attitudes or if we had better habits, something like that. So the psychological, physiological kind of link there is, it's imprecise. It's not a very satisfactory term, really.
So it's a term that really means you can't sleep and I don't know why.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
You got it. Yeah.
All right. But you can't bill for that.
Yeah. Right.
Phil, you know, Gail's right, of course, with this whole idea of blaming the patient, but there really are some do's and don'ts for sleep, yes?
Oh, well, definitely.
Yeah, and there are. I think oftentimes the do's and don'ts are oversold in the sense that people are often told, oh, if you just cut down on caffeine and exercise and do this and that, it's going to solve your problems. And it's a rare case that you can just change a few habits like that, and if you've had chronic insomnia, that it's now magically going to go away by changing a few simple behaviors.
What kind of treatments do you use with patients with insomnia, and what's most successful?
The main treatment, and really to a large extent, the sole treatment that's in use these days, non-medication treatment that is what's called cognitive behavioral treatment for insomnia. I often describe it as consisting of a series of different strategies and treatments that are designed in some ways to kind of break the cycle of insomnia. And what I mean by that is that for many people, they start having insomnia for a variety of reasons. And for some people, their sleep will improve over time, but for other people, it will keep going. And a classic way in which that can happen is you initially start having trouble sleeping, and now as nighttime approaches, you start thinking, am I going to have trouble tonight? And it may cause some tension or anxiety. And so the cognitive behavioral interventions might be designed to, or it might help to reduce some of that sleep-related anxiety and break that cycle. So that's kind of a simple case where of what this CBT approach is.
Well, I want to tell my story here that, you know, I had a sleep study, like I said, a decade ago, and I guess I had the same diagnosis as Gail. I was prescribed trazodone, which may or may not have a good track record, but I was prescribed a substantial dose. Trazodone is an old-fashioned antidepressant, and it was mild to moderately helpful for me, and it was around the same time that I began my practice of meditation. And one of the things I found through meditation is it's diminished my anxiety about going to sleep, and when I wake up in the middle of the night, I don't worry about it. I mean, if I'm up, that's just what I'm doing right now. I'm being up, and, you know, all the anxiety is diminished, and I have learned in a cognitive way that it doesn't ruin my life if I'm up, you know. So there's a whole lot less agitation going on in my head around sleep, and it sounds like, you know, what I've been through is a variation on cognitive therapy or alteration.
It is, and one of the treatments that's currently being tested for insomnia is mindfulness meditation. I don't know if that's the form that you're using.
Yes, it is.
Okay. And there are some promising data starting to come out that mindfulness meditation alone or combined with some of the other cognitive behavioral approaches can be helpful for some people with insomnia.
Gail, what have you been through?
Well,
should we just say everything?
Pretty much. And I have to say, there's no one size fits all. You know, I mean, the behavioral modification techniques. I interviewed a lot of people for this book. I interviewed a lot of insomniacs, and some have had success with the behavioral modification techniques. But for many people, no, they just simply haven't. It hasn't, you know, touched them.
Right.
And for me, it didn't. I have to say, my problem seems not to be anxiety about sleep. It just seems to be this general wakefulness in the middle of the night. I'm not thinking about sleep. I'm, you know, often thinking about my classes, or, you know, I'm often thinking about nothing. But of course, if you lie there long enough, you'll start finding something. And what you have to do really is, I mean, my way of breaking the cycle is to listen to books on tape. I don't like turning on the light and reading because it chases away my melatonin and it really wakes me up. But if I just sort of, you know, I always have a Walkman and a book I'm interested in, and I change the channel. I just try to get onto another, you know, area of interest, not my own, you know, my own writing or my own teaching or the conversation, you know, I hope to have tomorrow or something like that. It's really not anxiety about sleeping so much. It's just, I'm with the day. When I wake up after 2 hours, the day is there. You know?
I want to ask both of you, because you're both knowledgeable about the research. Can we talk about treatments that we know don't work? Is there such a thing?
I think something might work for anyone. I mean, I was amazed at how many things, like, people found help in homeopathic remedies. There's no scientific remedy for it, but by God, they did. Now, maybe it's placebo, but placebo is fine, you know. I just found that people found help all over the place, and so I came away with this message of try everything, and you may find something that fits your lock.
Let's go to the phones. We've got lots of people who want to join the conversation. Let's start with Pat. Hi, Pat.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, hi. I wanted to ask the guest something that's pretty important to me. I've been suffering insomnia very, very seriously for about 10 years now. And over the years before that, I've had multiple herniated discs. And, of course, I have a rare erosive inflammatory type joint disease. So going to bed at night with the fingers and the hips and such has been almost impossible. So for about 8 years now, I've suffered terrible insomnia. I might sleep for maybe 3 or 4 days, sometimes out of a month. Now, I work out religiously 2 hours a day. I look great. I don't understand why my body looks good, yet I'm so tired, and I'm just so sleep deprivated. I've tried Ambien, and they've given me everything possible. It'll work for 2 nights, and that's the end of it. As I get into my middle age, what should I do? Should I try more homeopathic, as you mentioned, or?
Have before I turn to the experts, let me just ask a question. Have you had a sleep study?
Yes, I did. I went into the sleep study program, and by about 5 o'clock, they saw I was just sitting, like, laying there, and they basically said, "Okay, Patrick, we got all your vitals for the night. You might as well just go home." And they just sent a report back saying, "We don't really know what the problem is. We wanted to go send you to something called a psychological pharmacologist or something like that for $800 an hour." And I was like, "Well, I don't have $800 an hour, so I'm not going there." I try not to read too many books or look at insomnia too much, because I don't want to focus on it, yet I never, ever sleep. It's just a very rare thing. I am healthy. I eat very healthy, but I just don't sleep. It's like I live the whole opposite of the way the rest of the world lives, yet I'm alive. I'm very healthy. People say I look great, but I don't sleep.
Phil?
I'm having a little trouble understanding the degree to which you feel like the lack of sleep is affecting you, in that there are some people who have problems sleeping, But then when I ask them, well, how does it affect you during the day, they'll say, well, I actually do pretty good with it. It doesn't seem to have as big of an impact as I would have expected, given the amount of sleep that I'm getting. And I'm less concerned about someone like that than someone who comes to me and says, oh, I can't sleep and it's destroying my life.
Well, Pat said he was tired all day. Yes, Pat?
Can lack of sleep, because I have to take, like, I'll take Ambien, the doctor give me Ambien that lasts 2 nights, so that's the end of it. It won't work at all.
Pat,
give me maybe a little bit of Valium, like a couple of times. I'll take that after 2 nights, it doesn't work anymore. Any medication they've given me, it only lasts for a couple nights, and that's it. I won't drink myself to sleep. I'll do that once a month. I hate
Pat,
it. Pat, my stomach's sick, so I can't do that. So
Pat, the question,
I'm not doing too bad if I don't really feel that bad. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the question is how you feel during the day. How do you feel?
I don't get a lot of tasks done as well, but I feel okay, to be quite honest with you. I just get scared that it might do something to my heart or to my body, because I just don't sleep. The system doesn't shut down to regenerate, if you know what I mean.
Well,
so,
Phil?
It's just for someone who doesn't sleep whatsoever, I was just scared to death.
Yeah. Phil?
I can tell you that there are only a few studies that have looked at the long-term consequences of insomnia, and the few that have looked at, for example, survival, don't seem to show an association between insomnia and shorter survival, contrary to what we know about sleep deprivation. So there's this disconnect we don't fully understand. So what I often say to people is the way that insomnia impacts you on a day-to-day basis is usually going to be worse than how it's going to affect your long-term health, although that's to some degree speculative.
Go on.
I remember a study that David Dinges I think he's still doing it, about finding that people react to sleep loss very differently. Some, he uses the term catastrophic, they're non-functional the next day, they're dangerous on the road. Others, in the middle, the sort of bulk of the population, they're not great, but they have, they sort of come back with their circadian rhythms. But then there's a kind that just doesn't seem to particularly register sleep loss the way other people do, either in terms of their functionality or their mood. And it may be that you're one of these, and it seems to be a genetic thing. People just seem to it's like he uses the term trait-like, and if it's not impacting your mood or your functionality, I probably not worry,
Yeah, the other thing I wonder, and I'll direct it to both of you, when we perceive ourselves as up for hours at night, we might not be up for hours at night. That our perceptions are, Phil?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. There have been a number of research studies where they have taken a group of people with insomnia and a group of people who define themselves as good sleepers and study their sleep using traditional EEG or brainwave measurements and looked at them and said, well, the people with insomnia seem to be sleeping just fine. Now, fortunately, people didn't stop there, and they realized, well, maybe it's something about the way we're measuring sleep, that we're using the naked eye to study what are complex brain patterns of activation. So they had computers go through with kind of a fine-tooth comb, and what they have found in several studies now is that when people with insomnia look asleep, just visually looking at their brainwave patterns, they actually show signs of wakefulness, that their brain is thinking about things. So it seems that it's possible for some people to get into a state at night where part of their brain is asleep, but part of it is still aware of what's going on and thinking about things, so that it's somewhat of a mixed state that's less restful than true sleep.
But more restful than activity.
Right.
I mean, if you got up and moved around, you would lose all the restfulness of it. Yeah.
Boy,
yeah.
You know, that raises all sorts of questions about research and brains. And I want to get to that after our break, because I know there have been some, our learning curve has been increasing over the last decade. So I do want to talk about that. I also want to talk about kids, what about kids who have difficulty sleeping. We're talking about insomnia with Gail Green, who's written the book Insomniac, and Dr. Phil Gierman, who is clinical director of behavioral sleep medicine program at the University of Pennsylvania. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Newman College, now Newman University, proudly supports WHYY. As a university, Newman will continue to offer undergraduate degrees in a range of majors, master's and doctoral programs, and an accelerated bachelor's degree program for adults. They will provide opportunities for academic scholarship and research while maintaining the community atmosphere Newman students have come to know, including respect for individuals, concern for the environment, and social responsibility. Newman University. Newman.edu.
A struggle for power and influence, divisions over race and equality, unlikely heroes and villains, the story of the nation's capital as seen through the history of its football team, the Washington Redskins. That's next time on Tell Me More. This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and we're talking about insomnia with Gail Green, who's authored the book Insomniac, and Dr. Phil Gierman, who's clinical director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at the University of Pennsylvania. Before our break, I said I wanted to talk about kids, so let's go to our callers. We've got Trish on the line. Trish, hi.
Hi, Dan. Hi. Hello, doctor. I was wondering about my daughter, who is about 8 years old, who's having trouble falling asleep. Are there any strategies to help her?
Great question. Phil?
It's interesting that you say she's an eight-year-old, in that there seemed to be a consensus that there's one approach to take when two-, three-, four-year-olds are having difficulty sleeping, which seems to be different from what we consider to be adult insomnia. And so, but the age at which one type of sleeping problem transitions to another is not clear, but it seems, when I talked with my pediatric colleagues, it seems like it might be around age eight. So it part of it depends on exactly what the nature of her sleeping problem is.
Trish, do you want to say?
Well, she seems to worry that she can't get to sleep, and then she worries that she can't get to sleep, which makes her anxious, and then she can't get to, it's like a vicious cycle.
Okay. Phil?
So that sounds more like what we would see in, say, teenagers or adults, that pattern of insomnia. One of the things we know for sure is that lying there trying to sleep only makes the matter worse. And so one strategy that often is helpful is that if you are lying there trying to fall asleep and you start really worrying a lot and thinking about the fact that you're not asleep, once your brain is engaged at that level, it's going to be very difficult to fall asleep. And often the longer you lie there, you just feel more and more anxious and worse. So one important component is to stop trying, essentially, and is to read a book, watch TV, or do something where basically you're giving yourself a break from trying to sleep, allowing yourself to wind back down before then getting back into bed and trying again.
Okay, sounds good to me.
Yeah, take pressure off of everybody. And the phrase, don't be worried about it, doesn't help.
How did you know that's what I told her?
Because I was a parent before I was a psychologist.
Makes sense. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I want to get to the issue of depression, that there's a strong association between depression and insomnia, and chicken egg cause effect, Gail?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there has been a kind of knee-jerk association with it. Oh, you can't sleep. Oh, you must be depressed. But recently, there's studies that come in that show that we may be depressed because we can't sleep. And any insomniac could have told you that, you know? I mean, actually, I'm depressed because I haven't had a good night's sleep since I can remember, and that will depress anybody. Now, granted, there's obviously other cases where people are depressed and therefore they can't sleep. I mean, but, you know, far fewer than we were told. So it's really good to have that knee-jerk kind of association, or not even association, equation of depression with insomnia. Really, it's been severed. I mean, now it's been dissociated. You don't get that kind of advice from doctors anymore of, you're depressed, have an antidepressant, you know.
Well, but they both still need to be treated. Yes, Phil?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I do agree with Gail that it's certainly a bidirectional relationship, that you know, whether depression or the insomnia starts first, they influence each other to a large extent. And sometimes it's very difficult to tease apart. Does someone require separate depression treatment? Because they may say they have the symptoms of low energy, low motivation, they're fatigued, and is that depression, or is that just because they're not sleeping well? And that can be difficult to tease apart. If it's a clear case of depression, especially if there's suicidality involved, you definitely want to do a combination treatment is what seems to be the best approach.
Hmm. Well, you know, in my case, I talked about this trazodone working. Not working, but, you know, really helping support sleep. I've, as a kid, as an eight-year-old, in hindsight, I probably had, you know, dysthymia more than my fair share of anxiety. And so I think that was the chicken or the egg or whichever comes first. I don't know how that works. So probably why it was effective.
It could be, but trazodone also has sedating properties that are effective regardless of depression, and it works on many people, and it doesn't work on many people. It's
right.
One of those things that, you know, the trial and error. It didn't work on me at all, and so you just have to find
right.
your own drug. But
yeah, you are clear about that trial and error thing, and the fact that. You know, we need some patience to find it.
Yeah.
I want to get to the neurobiology of depression, and I've been talking about how much things have changed over the last decade. Phil, let's start with you. What are we learning about a depressed brain? An insomniac brain.
Well, I'd actually argue that not much has changed in the last 10 years. And from reading Gail's book, I think she would agree with me that there's actually really been the neurobiology of insomnia has been greatly overlooked. And some studies are starting to come out, but not much has been done. I mean, probably one of the more exciting studies recently showed that when you did brain scans of people with insomnia, that they had lower levels of GABA, a neurotransmitter in the brain that helps to shut things down, essentially. Your GABA helps you to fall asleep at night. And there seem to be lower levels of GABA in people with insomnia. So that's some of the newer data that's coming out. But there's really not a whole lot going on.
Yeah, Gail, you mentioned that in 2005, National Institute of Health spent less than $20 million on insomnia research, where the makers of Ambien spent $123 million on its advertising budget alone. So what kind of statement does that make?
Well, it's pretty clear statement. Yeah. You know, I think people have shied away from insomnia because it's so difficult. I mean, it's not just one thing, you know, like narcolepsy is one thing. And so they were able to sort of zero in on that and look at it and make an amazing breakthrough, which found that, no, narcoleptics are not lazy or crazy. They just have a deficiency of a certain kind of wake-up neurotransmitter. And that's the kind of breakthrough we want with insomnia, but it'll be a whole lot more complicated because there are all these different kinds of insomnia. Some is hormonal, some is genetic, some is psychological, you know, because of depression or because of bad habits. So it's a whole lot more difficult to work with.
Well, let's hope the commitment is there, because it affects so many people.
I think it is. I just mentioned that wonderful GABA study. You know, that's exactly where the research needs to go.
Then maybe over the next decade. Listen, we've got our phone lines lit up and we're running out of time, so I want to make sure we get some of our callers in. Let's start with Norman. Norman, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a teacher at the Krefeld School in Philadelphia, and I've worked with a lot of adolescents who present with, depressive or otherwise kind of checked out behavior, and there's a lot of problem solving around, from the sort of therapeutic or clinical or psychiatric end. And then after, months of detective work, then finally somebody mentions that, oh, they're up IMing until 3 in the morning or something like this. And so I just, it speaks to the sort of the relationship between, depression and insomnia, and also sort of the like from the behavioral end and the parenting end, like what about some sleep hygiene? What about some good habits of, turning off things and, getting some exercise earlier in the afternoon and things like this?
Boy, you bring up a big question. Of course, adolescents need more sleep than anybody else, and Norman brings up the issue, the cultural issue. These kids now are up IMing and texting. Either of you have a reaction? Phil? Gail?
Well, one thing I do want to mention is that when you hit puberty, for most kids, there's a shift in your rhythms of sleep so that you naturally, biologically, want to go to bed at a later hour and sleep until a later hour. And for some people, this can be quite an extreme shift. And so what we often attribute to rebelliousness or laziness is actually a biological tendency in teenagers. Now, that being said, there's definitely a lot of competing demands these days with cell phones and instant messaging. And many teenagers have computers in their bedrooms these days and are emailing late into the night. So I think it represents a combination of biological predispositions, but also just maybe too much stimulation.
I would say that too. Yeah, I mean, there certainly are biological shifts in adolescence, but the stimulation, the distraction, I see this in my students, is just over the top. I mean, it's so different from when I had a problem in high school. I would have had a problem in spades, with all the texting and the computer, all the stuff. We are not a sleep friendly society on any level, starting with kids, going all the way through to professions, to, driven kind of work schedules. I mean, we just are not sleep-friendly. We don't respect sleep enough to make room for it in our lives. And, I mean, kids shouldn't have any of that stuff in their rooms, really.
There's even a certain amount of pride of being able to function on less sleep. Gail, you've said that you've searched and searched and that there's no support group for people with insomnia. And Phil, when we spoke to you, you said the same thing. That's really surprising of all groups.
Because there's so many of us. I mean, there's a couple of reasons. I think one is that insomnia is many things, and so we're a pretty heterogeneous group. But another thing is that we've been taught not to take sleep seriously. And so, get over it. Okay, maybe I really only need 4 or 5 hours of sleep. I should be tougher about this. Get a grip. There's all these messages in the air that kind of denigrate the idea.
I wonder if there's some shame attached to not being able to sleep. Phil, have you seen that?
I have. I have a lot of patients who I see in my clinic who say they're afraid to talk with anyone about it because they think it's going to be seen as a sign of weakness or that it's somehow their fault. And I think the common advice that people are often given by others when they say they're having trouble sleeping just reinforces that. So people are told, oh, all you have to do is drink some warm milk at night, or if you just kept a better schedule, and I think it just reinforces that feeling of, oh, this is my fault.
So I can't think of anything better for people who have sleep difficulty than some place to turn in the middle of the night to find some kindred spirit.
The computer offers some of that. There are these chat rooms, and people often go on. I have a blog and a website called sleepstarved.org, and I notice that people often post there at 3 a.m., and I answer them because I'm up at 3 a.m., and, you know, it's not great sleep hygiene, but on the other hand, it does make you feel that you're not so alone. You can kind of chat on the computer with other people, but no, there's no support group of patient-organized advocacy group that would get more research money for this problem. It's vastly under-researched, neglected scientifically.
Gail, let me just ask you quickly in our concluding moments. You really have devoted a great deal of time and energy, really devotion to this topic of insomnia. There's lots of people who don't sleep but have not been this devoted. What's the devotion about?
Well, for one thing, it fascinates me. Sleep fascinates me. It's the great undiscovered continent. There's so much that's not known about it. I've always been interested in my dreams and sort of in-between states I get into. As an insomniac, I've always been more aware of my sleep and sleep stages and what it does to me the next day. And so it's kind of this introspective. It's funny, it was going to be a memoir, but it ended up being a lot more about the science because I just got bit by the bug of that. It's so interesting what is known and what is not known, and it's so undervalued in this society. So I feel like I'm on a sort of crusade to get people to value, you know, this. I mean, it's a fuel of life. You cannot do without it any more than you can do without food.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I'm really glad your book really was a nice blend of science and memoir. And I hope you take a little nap after the show. My guests today have been Professor Gail Green, author of the book Insomniac. Her blog, again, is sleepstarved.org. We're also joined by Dr. Phil Gierman, and I want to thank you for joining us, Phil. He's an assistant professor in psychiatry. He's clinical director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at the University of Pennsylvania. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be having an open show on something called post-traumatic growth. And my web chat tomorrow is going to be on the issue of belonging. You can reach us at voices@whyy.org. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of radio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Alisa Walters is home still mending, and she's still our associate producer. Our intern is Jonathan Glick. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.